This is Stellacast, episode 17. Well, hello there, everybody. Guys and gals and cooks and chefs, what's up? Another episode of Stellacast, coming your way. My name is Jacob Burton. I'm your host, as always. Stellacast is found online at stellaculinary.com/scast. That's where you can find all of our episodes and show notes. And of course, stellaculinary.com has tons of cooking videos, two other podcast series, all for your culinary education pleasure. In this episode, we welcome back Kimberly Schaub, R&D chef that we had on the show back in episode 15, I believe it was. And at the end of episode 15, Kimberly was talking about how she was getting ready to head on out to Hong Kong on a trip with her husband. So, you know, as a lover of everything Asian, including the food, I said, well, you know what, Kimberly, after you come back from Hong Kong, we got to get you back on the show and talk about the food that you had over in Hong Kong. Because there's just this amazing food scene emerging. It has a lot to do with the melting pot that is Hong Kong. Anytime you find a geographical location that has been conquered and taken over and has influxes of immigrants from all over the world, you're always going to find a very fascinating melting pot of culinary traditions and techniques and food. That's why, I mean, Singapore is another great example of this. Singapore has people from all over Asia and really what we would call in the U.S. the Middle East, and just a vast, you know, cross section of all these different ethnic groups that come to Singapore, and they share their food and their culture, and it starts to commingle, and you get some really interesting styles of food and cuisine and cooking that come out of that. And the same thing is happening in Hong Kong. And also, too, that's one of the things that makes the food in the coastal states of the U.S. so fascinating. You look at the food culture in Washington, California, Oregon, New York, Florida, right? You have all these different cultures coming together. So we talked to Kimberly about that and all other sorts of ramblings. We get off topic. I go on a bit of a rant using some nasty words, so earmuffs and turn off, you got the kids, about the closing of all the cordon bleu schools in the United States. So that and so much more in this episode. Before we talk to Kimberly, I want to just mention real quick the F-Step curriculum, the written F-Step curriculum, is now available for download at stellaculinary.com. So you can head on over there and check it out. Stellaculinary.com, just click on the shop link at the top of the page. It'll give you some information on the F-Step curriculum and why you need it in your life. The quick tip is, it is awesome. That's why you need it in your life. But the first section, F is for Flavor, is available for free download. So you can download F is for Flavor, check it out, read through it, see if it's you know, the kind of info that blows your apron up and gets you excited. And if you like it, you can always download the rest of the book. So with that said, let's welcome Kimberly back to the program. How was Hong Kong?
It was awesome. Yeah. Hong Kong is absolutely a foodie city. There's also a really strong, I would say, chef community city element to it. But man, plan on walking a lot and spending a lot of money and really trying to avoid all of the tourist traps, because Hong Kong is really known for being a tourist, or sorry, for being a foodie city. So literally on every block, every corner you turn, there's this claim for world famous this and that dumpling or this and that snake soup. And you know, you kind of have to go carrying cash in hand and think to yourself, okay, I've got, I don't know, 500 Hong Kong dollars. How do I spend it wisely?
How do you walk past a sign that says world famous snake soup?
You don't. That's the one you go into.
Right on. Is it so it's expensive there in Hong Kong?
The food is not as expensive, say, as New York City would be. The exchange rate that we had was about $1 to $6.50 or $7. Generally speaking, I divided you know, the posted cost of an item by 7, and you got pretty close to how much you would spend in U.S. dollars. And so a cup of milk tea, which is really popular in Hong Kong, is about 4 U.S. dollars or 28 or 29 Hong Kong dollars.
Really? Those are like Starbucks prices.
Yeah, but it's Hong Kong milk tea.
But you're definitely not getting off cheap.
No, it's not, you know, it's not pennies, you know, to eat there. And we went to Hot Pot, which is, I don't know if all of your listeners are familiar with that, but it's kind of like a Chinese fondue party.
Mm-hmm.
So a pot of boiling broth is placed at the middle of the table, and then all around it are plates of raw foods that you cook in this boiling broth. And, you know, you can eat fairly cheaply at Hot Pot, but my brother and I decided to go all out and got Wagyu-style beef and lamb shank and all of this stuff. And so that cost us a pretty penny. That was,
nice.
I think, you know, $70 U.S. dollars per person. So our bill came, and it was something like 2,500 Hong Kong dollars or something, which I've never had a dinner where I've paid a price with a comma
in
the price. That was new.
Yeah, for sure, right?
At least you can divide by 7, but you're still like, wow, that was, you know, $300 US.
Was it worth it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so we went to a place called Megan's Kitchen, and it's in Wan Chai. So it's an area of Hong Kong that is less influenced by Western modernism, if you will. I mean, there's still the tall buildings, but it's still what people would picture of older Hong Kong. So there's still a lot of residents and smaller businesses. You go into this office building, there's a little guard that sits by the door. He has to buzz you in. And you feel like you're probably going to a banking appointment or a legal appointment, but you take the elevator to the 5th floor, and it opens up into this restaurant, kind of into the middle back hallway. You almost wonder if you've gone into the right floor. And
sounds so exclusive.
So exclusive, and yet definitely not once you walk all the way in. I mean, they put restaurants in any space available to them, I think. So, so Megan's Kitchen was in Wan Chai, in this kind of more Hong Konger part of Hong Kong versus, say, the Western Louis Vuitton area of the city. And they're known for having fusion broth. So instead of, say, a straight oxtail beef or beef oxtail broth, they have things like a tom yum soup broth, or I think we did oxtail stew broth. And they put a little divider in the middle of the boiling pot, so it kind of has a yin and yang symbol design. Uh-huh. And one side of the pot has broth A, and the second side has broth B. And it was really cool because you kind of switch back and forth and see the effect of the broth, the simmering broth, on whatever food it is that you simmered. And they had a tomato soup flavor. They had a cream of chicken, or a cream of corn broth. They had a miso soup. So it was just more unique broth flavors than your average hot pot place would have. And that's what Megan's Kitchen is known for.
And you really enjoyed it.
And I really enjoyed it and ate 2,400 Hong Kong dollars worth of food.
You know, there's a part of me, because I've done the hot pots before, and you know, I mean, who doesn't love Korean barbecue? But there's a part of me too, though, where like all this like interactive cooking stuff that people tend to love doing at the table, I'm just like, you know what, like this is like, I'm paying you to cook my own food. Can you just take it in the back and cook it for me? Normally, it's the other way around.
It's so true, though. I mean, they're. Were times, you know, especially with the Wagyu beef, you had to know exactly how long to leave your chopstick worth mm-hmm. of beef in there. Otherwise, you just get a really, really overcooked, really expensive slice of beef.
Yeah, so, I would probably just eat it raw. Just start
tempted.
Putting it in my mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would kind of anoint it through the broth, just kind uh-huh. of do the obligatory dip and go kind
yeah,
of thing. Oh,
swipe.
It was really good, though.
Yeah. When I was in the in the Sichuan region of China, I made the mistake of convincing, and I don't even think I convinced her. I just, the lady told me, you know, through our translator, that there are there are two spiciness levels. There is the spiciness level for the white people, and then there's the spiciness level for the locals. And I was immediately offended, and I was like, bring me the local spiciness level. And they brought it out, and I dipped a piece of meat into it. And it, when I put it in my mouth, it honestly felt like somebody, like a pro soccer player just kicked me in the gut. It was so hot. It was so hot. And I was, of course, embarrassed because, you know, my 17-year-old ego was just immediately shattered. And and I tried to struggle through a couple more pieces, but I ended up just, you know, pushing some food around in the hot pot and not really eating it. So if you're in Sichuan, be careful with their hot pots because they are definitely hot.
Words of wisdom for sure.
So what else did you eat there? I mean, I'm sure you had some dumplings. What else stood out to you?
So we made a point of going to Tim Ho Wan, which was the Michelin-starred dim sum restaurant. And I think there are three in Hong Kong, which, you know, then you're thinking, oh, well, it's just a chain. It is and it isn't. The Hong Kong way of opening a restaurant is you open a small space and you get as many patrons into that small space as possible. When you literally cannot fit any more people in there and you cannot turn and burn the tables fast enough to the point that you have a line out your restaurant for more than an hour, they will open a space adjacent to your property or whatever the next available retail space is. They'll open that. So it could be across the street. It could be around the corner. So they're not quite the Starbucks of dim sum, but it seems that way if you look at a list of their locations online. So we went to their Mong Kok location, which is on the Kowloon Island side. And it is I believe it was considered their second location because their original location had closed. And so we walked up to that restaurant and the restaurant opened at 9:30. We arrived at 10 and there were probably 40 people hovering around the front door and mobbing the host, at the stand. My brother had gotten there a little earlier, had gotten us, I think we were number 74 at that point. 30 minutes into service. Wow. I was like, oh my word. We finally get to sit down, and the dim sum that Tim Ho Wan served really was some of the best dim sum I had ever had. And that sounds insane to say, because you're thinking, well, it's such a savory dumpling series, and the majority of the dim sum houses that I've been to in the States or in Hong Kong or Vancouver, they're all really good. The flavors are usually spot on, and all of the dishes have a complexity that you either get or you don't get. But somehow, Tim Ho Wan upped the ante with extra folds in the dumplings that already have a lot of folds. The savory balance of flavors was even more perfected.
But wait a second, why would the folds make the dumplings better?
I think just in the complexity, because there's just even more touches to each dumpling than you would generically get. So say if you looked at a hagao, they're probably, I think they're supposed to be, I'm going to make this up and be totally wrong for whoever expert is okay. Listening. Say if there are 7 or 8 folds in a hagao, they would add, you know, 2 more. So each item gets an extra couple of touches. You know, and they're just beautiful.
That extra attention and detail.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And crazily, they had a barbecue pork dumpling that, the char siu pork is often served in those puffy white steamed buns. Mm-hmm. They're kind of thick, and then there's that sweet and savory rich barbecue pork in the middle. These ones were served in a, I think they're called a milk bread, almost more like a Hawaiian dinner roll, but round. Then the top has what they call pineapple topping and has no pineapple ingredients in it at all. It's this creamy custard that gets piped over the top of the raw buns And when they're baked, they crinkle up and become this kind of almost powder-like crumbly topping on top of these super rich, sweet buns with a savory and kind of barbecue-sauced pork on the inside. And I'd never had a bun like that before.
That sounds killer. That sounds like I'm writing this down right now because that sounds like something I need to do some R&D on.
Absolutely needs to be.
That sounds fantastic. So are your thoughts that they were doing like a, for lack of a better term, it's like a creme anglaise style custard where it was already cooked and they're kind of painting that across the top of the raw bun before they bake it? Is that your best guess?
No, it's definitely thicker. It's definitely piped on the way, I would guess that it's more of a pâte à choux dough texture or flow, if that makes any sense. So you'd really pipe that on and then it would kind of bake up. I looked up a recipe of someone trying to do a knockoff of it, and I'll send that to you and you can share that with your listeners.
Okay.
It's the closest I've seen, but it doesn't look exactly right based on, you know, the different television interviews that are done on Tim Ho Wan. Doesn't quite look the same. I've even seen some of the piped topping appear kind of greenish mm-hmm. in the raw form, but then look more yellow in the baked form.
Interesting.
Yeah.
A mystery. I like it.
You should do like little mini, you know, pork bun appetizer kinds of ideas. So you're not having to have a guest have a face full of dumpling, although that might be preferable. I could have eaten my way just that way. We ordered 3 trays and we only had 4 people. So that meant 3 buns per person.
I'm so intrigued. Cause first of all, I'm a huge, huge fan of just like the regular char siu bao. And mm-hmm. so now, but I also do a, like one of my favorite guilty pleasures is the, hamburger brioche buns, that I posted a while ago. So, I mean, such a versatile dough recipe, but you take those, you scale them down smaller and stuff them with, sloppy Joe mix before you bake them. And they are, it is so damn good. It is like, you will literally eat yourself sick off of them. Like one bite and any sort of self-control or that mechanism in your head that says no more, I'm full, just kind of like completely deteriorates. And so to me, like this kind of sounds like a Hong Kong style version of that, where they have that Hawaiian style sweet roll with the char siu bao in it, and then they have this mm-hmm. mystery crumbly topping over the top. That just sounds, I got to start working on it.
Yes, I agree. I'll drive over tomorrow.
I found my new R&D project.
It was really incredible. So with char siu bao, a char siu bao is the one that most of us in America have seen. So it's that big puffy white
steam
bun. Then there's a char siu so, mm-hmm. and sorry again to all of the people who can speak Cantonese. A char siu so is barbecue pork put inside a flaky lard baked triangle of dough and has I think it's like a milk wash over the top. So the flaky dough has that incredible layering that you can really only get with a lard dough.
Are we talking like a pie crust?
It's more like a pie crust. It's less, I don't know, it's not a laminated dough. So it doesn't have that puff from butter and steam.
Okay. So it's not a croissant dough.
It's not a croissant dough, but it is the most incredible layered sort of dough. But I'm almost certain it's from lard. The layers exist that are thin.
The char siu, you're saying so. How do you spell the so part? Is that S-O?
I think just S-O.
Okay. Just for my to Google notes later.
Right. And they are brown and golden flaky triangles that are served. Usually you have to special order them or they'll show up not on those steam carts, but on the little, non-temperature carts where you'll see the egg tarts and the Chinese dumplings, that kind of pastry cart in dim sum. So that, again, that's that same chashu pork filling inside a different type of bun. So now I've discovered that there are three very distinct chashu pork dishes. You've got the bao, you've got the so, and then you have this pineapple bun thing. And I don't actually know what its real name is because they just called it a pork bun. And so when I ordered it, I was actually thinking it was going to be a chashu bao, okay, not this other item.
Right.
We did discover that the foods that we loved in Hong Kong are always called traditional Chinese XYZ. And, you know, some generic name like traditional Chinese peanut snack. And you're like, oh, that's great. That's not Googleable.
those were the places to go.
Yeah, they absolutely were. The ones where as soon as my husband would cross the threshold, they'd go, oh no, one of us has to be able to speak English. And then I'd cross the threshold and they'd think, oh good, she could translate. And then much to their extreme disappointment, I'm about as useful in Chinese as he is. So it's like, oh man.
So
I definitely came away thinking I better learn some restaurant Chinese before I go back again.
I know, right? I mean, just to be able to order all the good stuff.
Yeah. I think if you could memorize the words of the dishes that you love, mm-hmm. and when you sit down, you can tell them how many people in your party, which tea you want to drink, because there are, you know, 300 types of Chinese green tea to choose from, and then just blurt out all of the words that you know of the dishes that you know, you'd end up with a pretty good meal every time.
Maybe you just learn how to say, feed me. You just walk in, sit down, feed me.
Just put your credit card on the table and see what happens.
Yeah. Or no white person food.
That is very key.
Yeah, keep all the tourist stuff away from me.
Exactly. Yeah, we tried pretty hard to get away from the mainstream restaurants. Although, again, Megan's Kitchen will show up and Tim Ho Wan will show up on a lot of TripAdvisor and Lonely Planet posts. You won't necessarily see them. I don't know. I think Rick Steves might also bring it up, but they're for the well-traveled folks who are more daring, but there are as many locals at these restaurants as there are foreigners, and that's always a good sign.
Yeah, most definitely. How about noodles? You guys get down any bowls of noodles?
So the place to go to noodles is Max Noodle House, M-A-K, Max.
Okay.
And they have the best wonton noodle there, and that's basically I don't even know if they're fresh noodles, but they're a little nest, tightly wound nest of egg noodles with a perfect shrimp wonton that is sweet and tender. And the wonton, while it holds its shape, you know, to pick it up with your chopsticks and everything like that, the dough is so tender it just kind of slips away. While most of the texture is actually in the noodles itself, which are really nice and glutiny noodles. Incredible. And I think it makes a good case, actually, for the judicious application of MSG, though, because while it is a perfect broth, and you can see kettles of broth boiling away in the little kitchens, they definitely add MSG. All of the food in Hong Kong that wasn't touted as healthy had this quality and kind of extra flavor characteristic to it that I would personally characterize as being from MSG.
Well, just not the same without it. You know, I mean, you try and make any number of, especially Asian style broths, it really isn't the same without a little bit of MSG in there.
It's really not. Yeah, you can make a super concentrated dashi with kombu and bonito, but even with that, I would argue that MSG, just a tiny bit of it, kicks it up a notch.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And I feel bad for anyone who still believes MSG is the Satan, because they are really missing out on life.
They really are. Yeah. Pity the fool who misses out on that.
Yeah. Take a trip to Hong Kong and have yourself some MSG, for sure.
And start working on your immunity, because I would argue that, you know, say if you think you have headaches from MSG, really, though, look in your cupboards and see what's there. If you've got Doritos or any other cheesy powdered snack food, you're already eating MSG. So if you can handle Doritos and not get Chinese restaurant migraines, then you're fine.
Well, there's actually never been a single double-blind study that has shown any sort of ill effects from MSG. It's just total mass hysteria. And what's crazy is, so glutamate is a neurotransmitter that your body actually will produce up to 40 grams of glutamate a day just to be able to communicate with itself through its neurons. Mm-hmm. And then you need sodium, right, for cellular function to live. And you put sodium and glutamate together. Well, guess what? You have monosodium glutamate. So,
you know, whoa, I mean, scary.
I know, maybe, you know. So maybe it's something else. I mean, it's when you go, especially when you go to some of the, like, the really greasy Americanized Chinese restaurants, you know, when I eat big bowls of grease that are just loaded with salt, I mean, it might be awesome going down, but you don't really feel that great afterwards. You know, the salt bloats you and the grease makes you feel heavy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's any number of things that could be causing you discomfort after you eat a massive heaping bowl of sweet and sour pork and chicken chow mein. But MSG isn't what's causing it. Sorry to burst the bubble.
I would be curious, though, if any of your longtime members of Stella Culinary actually still believe in the MSG myth. Because I would guess that your audience is pretty well educated as far as that goes.
They are, yeah. And I mean, I've been preaching it for a while. So the ones who are still around, they don't believe it, and the ones who can't be convinced otherwise, they have since left me a long time ago. You know, because I mean, I won't. You know, it's like, show me the science on it. I mean, everything says to the contrary, and I mean the whole MSG thing was started back in the 70s when a guy wrote a letter to the editor of the Journal of Science and said, hey, you know, when I eat Chinese food, my shoulder gets kind of stiff and I feel like I have a little bit of a headache. And then the Journal of Science, they published this. And now when people were going, and it wasn't even a peer-reviewed piece. It was a letter to the editor. But so now in the 70s, people would go to their doctor and say, hey, doc, you know, I'm having issues with migraines. You know, I get headaches and, you know, or my hand is sore. It's flaring up. And the doctor says, well, do you by any chance eat Chinese food? Like, well, hell yeah, I eat Chinese food. Who doesn't? It's awesome, right? Well, they put MSG in it, and the Chinese are evil people that are trying to make you sick and kill you. So, you know, and it is, and they call it Chinese restaurant syndrome. I mean, you know, so borderline racism aside, it's you have this mass hysteria that just evolved.
Yeah.
Which led to one of the biggest culinary travesties of all times. Which was these poor Chinese restaurant owners being browbeaten into putting signs in the restaurant window that says no MSG added. And mm-hmm. and to me, the no MSG added sign just means, hey, just keep on walking, bud.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. But at the same time, you know, it comes down to us as culinary professionals to educate people to try and find a way to say, hey, did you like that? Did you get a migraine afterwards? Mm-hmm. That was MSG. And, you know, again, from an industry perspective, and when I work in an organic, all-natural, clean-label brand, I have half of my pantry taken away from me, and I'm not kvetching just to kvetch. Like,
right.
There is a reason for all of those ingredients, and some of them can be applied less heavily than they are. But each of those ingredients was developed for a reason. And the reason is to make it taste good, to have a long shelf life, and to have it taste good both at my factory and in the grocery store, and then when it languishes in your pantry for another couple of weeks.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of the food industry.
Well, and they want the best of both worlds. It's like they want to eat healthy food, but they also want to be able to have it sit in a package for 3 months on their shelf at room temperature. It's like, go get yourself a banana.
that's good counseling there, folks. Just go get yourself a banana.
Get yourself a banana. All right. Anything that we missed on your Hong Kong trip?
Oh, man. You know, I was surprised. We stayed in a really western part of Hong Kong where a lot of the millennials like to party. And I was really interested to see that once you can get past all of the blaring lights of the, you know, the Hard Rock Cafe and Gordon Ramsay's latest attempt at restaurants in the area, you start to dig into some of those small foodie fusion places. There are some cute little gems. There was actually a restaurant. Wait, let me look up its name before I forget. I think it was called Little Bao.
Okay.
And it was a Baozi fusion restaurant in the Lan Kwai Fung area of Hong Kong. Lan Kwai Fung, or LKF, is a really trendy spot for kind of the millennial, I guess, yuppie business person. And but what you've got there is kind of the perfect blending of all of these, this next generation of expats or expatriates, of Hong Kongers who were raised in British Hong Kong, of Hong Kong Chinese people who were born or raised in other countries who've come back to Hong Kong or gone to Hong Kong as kind of an exploration of their heritage. And so you have this funny blend of modern and ancient Chinese. Yeah, so the restaurant is called Little Bao, and it is in Central, which is the kind of the main area, and then the tiny neighborhood is called Lan Kwai Fung. And they had bao sandwiches. So again, it's that white puffy bun. And then they would put, you know, pork belly and lamb shank. And I'm pulling up the menu right now to read it to you because I just was really excited by the things that I saw on their menu. They had, they have a grass-fed organic beef, tomato jam, roasted onion, sesame mayo, shiso, and cheddar cheese, bao. They had a fish tempura with fish, tamarind, palm sugar glaze, pickled lemongrass, fennel salad, a sloppy chan. So this kind of goes back to your sloppy Joe idea.
Love it.
Taiwanese braised shiitake tempeh, truffle mayo, sweet pickled daikon, and fried shallot. I mean, the things off that menu are things you would find in San Francisco that would get written up and fantasized by, you know, magazine writers in the Bay Area. And it was in this cute, tiny little spot. I mean, they didn't even have tables. They had a walk-up bar, you know, where you could belly up and get a cocktail. And then I think they had a couple of highboy tables, and that was it. You either took your thing to go or just stood on the street, just like you would next to a food truck. It was incredible.
You know, that was actually my exact train of thought, is, you know what needs to happen is, we need to go to Hong Kong. We need to kidnap these guys and have them do a food truck. Like,
yeah.
there needs to be, because dumplings aside, you also have those sandwiches that they do with the dumpling style rolls and dumpling style buns. And not only would that kill it, but could you imagine making your way out of a bar with maybe a drink or two in your system at 2 o'clock in the morning and seeing like a big, who am I kidding? Say 10 drinks in your system at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It's like, really?
Yeah. And you see like just this big, beautiful sign of, you know, of a food truck doing like Hong Kong style dumplings and sandwiches.
Oh my gosh. That would be
so massive. You have, what are those Mexican sandwiches called? Tortas. Yeah. So, I mean, you see those a lot in food trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really, I mean, they're still in vogue, but they really started to kind of like hit that trendiness like 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
With the food truck scene. Man, if you started doing like Hong Kong style dumplings and then dumpling style sandwiches out of a food truck, you would absolutely slay it.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. There is a bao place in San Francisco, and I'm looking up its name real quick. And they have an idea like that, where it's these really great grab-and-go baos, and I believe they started off as a food truck, and they're now a brick-and-mortar.
Mm-hmm.
In Oakland, possibly. And those are really good. I'm just trying to find their name. But it's not quite the same, you know, because these are still, you know, it's still very Chinese and very niche in some senses. You know, you either are like, oh yeah, Chinese bao, love them.
Right.
Or you've never heard of them. A food truck with a bao.
That needs to change though.
I agree. Hey, what are you doing next weekend?
I know, right?
Let's start a food truck.
Yeah. I would.
So if anybody's listening in Alabama, you should totally start something out there because nobody's heard of this stuff out here, you know, out east of California, I think. I mean, there's great Asian food in California, but as soon as you start to push east, you know, all kind of drops off and becomes either P.F. Chang's, not bad restaurants, P.F. No. Chang's or Panda Express, or really the mom and pop of the immigrant family that got themselves to South Dakota. And they're like, well, dang, I guess we'll open a restaurant. People want sweet and sour pork. We'll bring it to them. But nothing for this new generation of restaurateurs and foodies.
Yeah, there's no dumpling shop to my knowledge within like 75 miles of me.
Oh,
which is crazy because
depressing.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, and you know, Reno is about, you know, because I live in Truckee, so Reno is about 30-35 miles down the freeway on 80. And Reno's really exploding. It's like coming into its own in the last few years with just becoming an amazing food town and a lot of great ethnic cuisine. But to my knowledge, there's still not like a legit bao shop or, you know, dumpling shop. And I mean, so I don't know if it's the market or people just, you know, you don't have the people in the area to do it. But man, I would probably have to go get a second job just to support my bao habit if I was one in the area.
It's so true. You know, I think some of it, from a cook's perspective, especially from my perspective as a young in the career, I don't know that baos initially sound sexy and exciting enough. You know, as a chef like you who has been the exec of a well-known place, you're thinking, oh yeah, sure, I could open something that's more passion than excitement or praise worthy.
Right.
But as a young cook, I think to myself, well, I want to be in a Michelin restaurant. I don't want to sling bao. Because we associate it with tortas, possibly, and may kind of look down on it, which is a foolish initial reaction to have, because these types of foods, that's really what people go back to day after day. I can afford, oh, I can't even, but I can afford one Michelin restaurant a year, maybe.
Right.
But I could go get a $7 bao twice a week, probably.
Well, but so the thing is, though, too, you look at the dumpling shops in San Francisco, and they, I mean, you, if you peek back in the kitchens, their kitchens are massive and you never see a white guy back there. And it's, they have an army of Chinese people putting these together, which I assume was like, they're all family related or connected would be my assumption only because the amount of labor that's involved to, and bao's are very, you know, they are probably a low food cost, so very profitable, but there's still a, you know, when you look at the contribution dollars that they make to the bottom line, you know, you have to, you know, you have to sell a lot of steamed buns to make your rent payment in San Francisco proper. So
yeah,
the army of people that it takes to just sit back there and do this monotonous work of just, you know, dumpling after dumpling after dumpling, I think is probably a limiting factor in a lot of, you know, dumpling shops opening up in other areas. You know, I mean, so even if somebody who knew how to make dumplings made their way to Reno and decided, hey, I'm going to open up a dumpling shop, like who would they hire? There's no way they're going to be able to make all those dumplings themselves.
No way. Yeah, whenever I helped a friend with his pop-up, it called Kraken Kanji in Seattle. And, you know, whenever I jump into a team, I tend to go to Garde Manger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing their dumplings and spring rolls for one of their dinners. Man, talk about human labor involved in these stupid little things. And they're not actually the most expensive items on the menu.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so, oh, it's painful, honestly, because that's what people ordered the crap out of at the restaurant. You know, you'd get three congees among four of you, say, orders of spring rolls and whatever other dumplings I'm trying to fire off. And it was just like, okay.
Yeah, it's the
I think actually our dishwasher jumped in I had to save my ass a couple of times because I just was dying. It was so bad.
It's the same.
There's so much work, and it's crazy.
It's the exact same thing with sushi. Like, if you look at an actual sushi roll, when you're making a sushi roll, there are so many damn moves to the plate just for a simple roll. It's maddening. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just the amount of knife cuts and the rolling. And I spent a year as the head chef of a Asian fusion restaurant that, you know, did sushi rolls. And I swore to myself, I will never, ever do a restaurant that does sushi, ever. When I'm planning a new dish for my menu, one of the important things that goes into it is execution, obviously. And I'm always looking at how many moves to the plate. So I need to take this food that's prepared and I need to move it to the plate and arrange it and make it look beautiful, make it look like it's worth whatever they're paying for it. And, you know, so even like a more complicated plate up, you know, maybe you're doing, say, 15 to 20 moves to a plate, and that's in a fine dining setting. And we're not mm-hmm. talking about like a 3 Michelin star, you know, where they have like a whole army plating one dish. But there's a good, I mean, when you're doing a rainbow roll for $15, that's a 15 move plate easily right there. Mm-hmm. And you got people ordering them like they're going out of style. I remember, and then at this place, where I was a chef, we would do half off sushi night on Thursday if you sat at the bar. And I would just get crushed. I would get crushed. And the tickets would just start stacking up. And I'm just like, God, I fucking hate sushi. I hate it so much.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. I worked at a restaurant in Seattle as a front of house person. Then I would stage in the back. Mm-hmm. And the sushi chef there, really awesome Japanese-American guy who had clearly, been doing sushi his entire life. He'd probably been washing rice since he was 16.
Right.
And so he let me get on there. And essentially, my fish cuts became the spicy tuna special for that night because I was just like, you know, I wasn't precise enough. It would take me probably a year of fish cutting to get good enough. And it was insane. I mean, the prep to his station alone took me all day. And then I would go on shift and go to front of house and he would work. And it was just like, oh my gosh, I'm exhausted. And I wasn't doing any of the complicated stuff. I was just doing the piddly little, you know, station setup things.
Yeah. Like the hand rolls, the ice cream cone hand rolls.
Yes.
Those took me 4 months to learn.
Oh,
like,
man.
To do it properly. You know, like, people who eat sushi, please, please tip your sushi chefs well, because that is, I mean, they are back there, and a guy who makes his job look easy behind a sushi bar is a true badass, probably one of them. You know, I mean, you look at the dexterity that they have in their hands with their knife cuts and being able to roll these rolls in a timely fashion. I mean, it's just, to me, it's always very impressive.
Yeah.
And for the love of God, stop stirring your wasabi into your soy sauce dish.
Oh, please. My God.
Please stop.
Thank you for bringing that up. That drives me absolutely insane to the point that I have judged good friends of mine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So embarrassing. I mean, I feel guilty, but not really, because it is the wrong way to eat sushi. I mean, please, people, stream the video I think is it Jiro? Talks mm-hmm. about the proper way to eat sushi, which is, you know, honestly, sometimes you can pick it up with your hands.
Yeah.
So wash your goddamn hands. But, yeah. And yeah, I actually do not have tamari with me at all, because I think the sushi roll or the sashimi or the nigiri, whatever it is that you're eating, mm-hmm. should be perfectly balanced. And there is a right way and a wrong way to make sushi. You know,
right.
A fatty fish gets served with wasabi between the fish and the rice. That's a nigiri.
But that's so, but that, I mean, I understand that, but that's also, I mean, to be fair, that's in a perfect world as well. Like, Reno is filled with these all-you-can-eat sushi places that are packed with people who just come in and stir a bunch of wasabi into their soy dishes.
Mm.
You know, so it's almost like, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? So, yeah, I mean, you need good sushi to not need soy sauce or wasabi or the pickled ginger. But is that what you're getting? But also too, if you walk into a real sushi restaurant and you sit at the bar, and they see that you're constantly dipping your nigiri into your soy dish, they're going to pack that nigiri tighter so it doesn't fall apart when you're dipping your nigiri into it. And really, if you do feel like you need a little bit of a dip, you flip the nigiri upside down and you run the fish side through, holding it in your fingers, and you pop it into your mouth. Because the whole point of the nigiri for our listeners is you have this supposed to be body temperature rice that's seasoned, that is packed just enough to be a platform for the fish, to where when you pop it into your mouth, each individual grain of rice kind of crumbles apart in your mouth and gives you that beautiful texture. But if the sushi chef sees you, you know, placing your nigiri into your soy dish, and then putting it in your mouth, he's going to start packing the rice a lot tighter, and you're going to get a inferior experience.
Yeah. I think for me, sushi is one of those things that I will pay through the nose for because, yes. You know, one, I want that fish to be its ideal experience. One, because you're eating raw fish. And two, because you're eating raw fish. You know, you want that perfectly healthy fish to have been prepared by someone who lovingly handles his or her craft and can do it well. And I will, I don't go to sushi buffets. I don't go to the conveyor belt sushis because there's not time for the cooks to be loving with the fish. And that sounds so weird, but, you know, so my husband and I have very particular restaurants that we go to, and we very carefully vet out any new places, for that reason, because there's a craftsmanship that we don't understand well in the United States as easily because we may not have that available to us. And I want to pay for that craftsmanship. And I also want to pay for that company to buy in good quality fish.
Yeah. But then you end up in a place like Reno and you haven't had sushi in 7 months. You're like, screw it. I'll just go to all you can eat and hammer some back. You know, it's not ideal, definitely. But and there's a couple of decent places in Reno, but nothing like San Francisco, you know.
Yeah.
Or any large city.
I'll agree. I am a little luckier, and I did just move away from Seattle, so I do still have that big city snobbery going with me right now. Right. Talk to me in another couple of months when I've been in what I feel like is a food desert.
Yeah.
And we'll see how desperate I get.
Yeah, no, I mean, you break down, you start searching things out, and even like in the turn and burn sushi restaurants, you can usually find like one or two guys behind the counter that really give a shit, and then you kind of belly up to the bar and like you know, look them in the eye, and you're just like, hey man, like, just make me some sushi, like, I'm down for whatever, you know, pull a 10 or a 20 out of your pocket before you start and just drop in their tip jar, and you know, get rocking, because they know, I mean, they respect their craft, and they know what to, they know what are the pitfalls that they're trying to kind of catch you on, and they also know what their best things are. I mean, you normally always have at least a couple of knowledgeable guys behind the bar that know what they're doing, and they're going to kind of steer you the right way. So that's why you always want to sit at the bar. You drop a 20 and you say, "Omakase, motherfucker."
Just like that too.
Yeah. They always love it. Yeah. And omakase is, I forget what the exact translation is, but it's basically, hey man, just do your thing.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like chef's choice, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, and so with that said though, you can't be one of those picky people. And also too, so this is how you order at a sushi bar if you want to look legit. So you sit down, you know, A 10 is a reasonable tip to start the meal. So just drop a 10 in the jar and say omakase. And then when you pull the chopsticks out of your package, do not rub them together. Okay, that is offensive to the sushi chef. Okay, they're very sensitive artists. So do not rub your chopsticks together and do not stir wasabi into your soy dish. In fact, leave your soy dish completely empty until you feel it necessary to fill up and actually use some soy. And that will signal to the sushi chef, hey, this guy or girl knows exactly what they're doing. They just gave me a nice tip to start off. I'm going to take good care of them. And the guy a couple of seats down that rolls and say, hey, give me a Bud Light. Oh, wait, you don't have it in the can? Okay, well, fine. I guess a bottle's okay. I'll take a Bud Light and starts immediately stirring wasabi into his soy sauce. Who do you think is going to get the better fish? Who do you think is going to get the better service?
Oh, yeah. It's so true. And that can be applied. I mean, you can expand out that kind of insider knowledge to so many different cuisines. I mean, belly up to the bartender, belly up to that the pass, honestly. I mean, not on a busy night, but, you know, poke your head in there, greet the guys in the back who are sweating their balls off and have been there since, you know, 8 in the morning, whose station got fucked up by the guy the night before.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. All right. So Josh and I escaped to Oakland and San Francisco last weekend. And so we're coming off having been to Hong Kong. We're still kind of reeling from moving and everything like that. But we escaped San Francisco. I made him stand in a line for state bird provisions, which is still one of the really popular top trending restaurants in San Francisco. It's been there for a couple of years. And so we showed up an hour before the restaurant started and got into the queue. I think we were number 30 in the line of people. And we got the last two top, and it was in front of the oyster chef, I guess, or oyster cook. And so we got to watch him prep all of the cold kind of seafood dishes that they were doing that night. And it just, you know, you just, when you've gotten to stab yourself with an oyster knife more than once, you kind of feel a camaraderie with the guy sitting across from you who's still doing it. And I've never actually like fully crucified myself. I've had friends who've done that. That's pretty impressive. But so I was talking to the guy about just what he was doing and what he loved about his craft or hated. And, you know, the treatment and the little extras that would kind of show up at our little table were a lot because we connected with people. You know, you're a patron and he's the cook. And the other guy's a chef and a manager and whatever. But there is that brotherhood or brother sisterhood that does occur among kitchen folks. And just knowing how to eat the food that they're preparing is a big piece of it. And then to know how to talk about it too.
And that's the way to get the real hookup in the restaurants is, you know, people come in and, you know, you got a little extra money in your pocket and you drop a big tip for the server. And, you know, the next time that you're in the restaurant, the server's going to pat you on the back and smile at you and make sure you get, you know, extra good service. But you want to have top-notch service, it comes from the chef down. So you give love to the kitchen, you could have the shittiest server in the entire restaurant. He's going to all of a sudden turn to the best server because you got the chef back there saying, hey, that guy on table two, he is a personal VIP of mine. Take this to him. This is on the house. And you make sure that he wants for nothing. And just showing up and showing a little bit of love and respect to the kitchen before the meal, I mean, you would be surprised at how much free food a six-pack of beer will get you. If you show up to a restaurant with a six-pack of good beer, and you're like, hey, you know, this is for the kitchen for later tonight when they're cleaning up. You know, I'm big fans of their food. And then you go and sit down. Be amazed at what starts hitting your table.
Yeah.
Because those are the guys that hold the control. It's not the people in the front of the house that, you know, I mean, and obviously the servers, they play a very vital role, especially in higher end food. But, you know, I mean, you want the real hookup. You make friends with a chef. And chefs don't have a whole lot of friends because they spend all their time at work. So we're actually pretty easy to make friends with, you know, a couple of beers, a kind word that strokes our ego. And all of a sudden you're being treated like a member of the family.
Yeah, so true. I don't know. I mean, that's the one piece that I didn't get to access when we were in Hong Kong. I think because there is a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier because the culinary crews, I guess, in restaurants there are not idolized somewhat the way they are in the U.S. I mean, it's still very much blue collar work in Chinese restaurants and in Hong Kong. But it's still there. You can still see the people who love what they're doing. And I think it's starting to develop where more or less more affluent, possibly foreign born or foreign exposed restaurateurs are starting to make inroads in Hong Kong. So it was interesting to see that that food industry is actually changing pretty rapidly.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I had a really good friend of mine. He spent a couple of years in Shanghai. They basically got recruited to go over there and help open up like a Western style restaurant. And,
oh, cool.
So they obviously pay for all of his travel expenses. They pay for his housing, right? They put him up in a nice apartment. And I believe his salary was like 80 to 90,000 US a year. But he wasn't paying for anything, right? So that 80 to 90,000 US went really far. I mean, they were paying his rent. He was eating at the restaurant, single guy. His sous chef, his second in command, who was born and raised in Shanghai, a Chinese native, was making $5,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's definitely a disparity going on. I mean, they will treat Western chefs like rock stars to get them over there and to kind of, you know, put their name on something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Well, but you know, the thing is though too, is it's not like, and what he was telling me is that was at the time considered a very good, respectable wage for work. It was a good salary. And you look at what the average kitchen person makes in the United States, and it's not a whole lot over minimum wage usually. You know, the average cook, you know, I mean, I think like the average is 28,000 a year. Average for a sous chef is like in the $34,000 range. So, yeah. I mean, they're making just enough to not get government assistance.
Yeah. But not enough to actually ever get out of debt.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I really feel bad for the guys that are coming out of culinary school with a $60,000, $100,000 debt.
Oh.
Speaking of which, did you hear the Cordon Bleu is closing down all of their U.S. schools?
Yes.
Isn't that crazy?
It is. I wanted to get your opinion on that. You go first.
Oh, good riddance. My certificate, my culinary degree is from Le Cordon Bleu San Francisco, California Culinary Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, yeah, fuck them, really. Because when I started at Le Cordon Bleu San Francisco, they had just been bought by this education company. And so the education company decides that they're going to, as the new owners, they start dropping a ton of money into this place, right? So they built out a second campus, brand new. And my class was the first class to go through. We broke in all those new stoves, the whole new campus.
Oh, man.
Right?
Nice.
So it was awesome. And we still had the carryover from all these really great chefs that were there as instructors. And after I graduated, let's not kid ourselves. It wasn't like this spectacular, amazing experience when I was there, but it was still decent. It was still respectable. When I graduated, they started cutting costs like left and right. They closed down the main campus. They stopped offering a 2-year associate degree. Like their culinary program went from 18 months to like 9 months, and they just totally watered down the curriculum. And, they laid off a bunch of great teachers, and I remember I started getting I would get externs from the CCA to come up and do their externship with me, and I mean I remember one time specifically I make an emulsion, I hand it to this extern, and I say, hey, go strain this through a chinois for me, and I started doing something else, and he calls me over, and he says, hey, chef. It's not working. I think the chinois is broken.
What?
And so the chinois is filled with this emulsion, and he's just holding it over like a container. And I'm like, okay. Dude, grab a fucking ladle and push it through the chinois. Like what did they teach you? And I would have to teach these kids. I got a baking and pastry student. So their baking program was 9 months. I had to explain to her the baker's percentage and how it worked and how you scale bread, right? I had to train these graduates who spent $60,000 fucking dollars on their culinary education how to break down a chicken. Mm-hmm. They couldn't even break down a whole chicken. So the cordon bleu, good fucking riddance to you. Good riddance. Yeah. That's my opinion on that. I hope it wasn't too strong.
Well, you know, I just feel like I don't really know how you feel about something.
Yeah,
I'm totally tough to read agree. Sometimes. Yeah, so Seattle used to have what was called the Kitchen Academy, and that was an accelerated, not very expensive, 9-month program in kind of an industrial part of town. It was definitely considered more of a trade school than this for-profit educational system, and it got purchased by Le Cordon Bleu as well. And there was a massive, rather insane turnover of instructors, which always makes me wonder when all of the rats jump ship, there might be something going on.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle of evaluating different culinary programs at the time, and I heard that they were switching over from Kitchen Academy to Le Cordon Bleu. And I had worked for a few catering companies in Colorado in a previous life, and the restaurateur I worked for there had nothing to say that was, something that could be shared with mixed companies, so to speak, about Cordon Bleu graduates. So when Kitchen Academy got purchased by Cordon Bleu, I was like, there's no way. I'm not going to go there and spend, I think it was $17,000 a semester, and it was 4 semesters or something like that. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm good. You know, $45,000 wow. later for an $11 an hour job, that math doesn't work.
Yeah, so.
So when I was in culinary school, I was working at a restaurant for a chef who more or less made her name through a popular restaurant in Seattle, opened another one, and she hired me as garde manger, and then, no, as a prep cook, and then hired a bunch of Kitchen Academy graduates and Cordon Bleu guys. And those guys, I managed to climb over them in rank within the first few months because they couldn't, one, break down a chicken, couldn't fry a crepe without burning the shit out of it, couldn't can something, which is a problem from a food safety perspective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, okay, I am at a community college program because I am trying to earn some stripes to move to another career. And these guys would come in and say, well, I'm from Le Cordon Bleu. Move aside, little one. And one, you know, and then they were worthless. There were so many times that I would prefer to pull our dishwasher up or even have some of our front of house guys help me, you know, get through a certain volume of product before I'd ask any of those Kitchen Academy kids to help or the Cordon Bleu kids. And I think for people who spent the money and the time to fly to Paris and study there, their degrees were so watered down by having this Cordon Bleu US, you know, version where everybody's like, oh, you went to Cordon Bleu. And it's like, no, I went to Cordon Bleu Paris.
Right.
Like, oh, that's better, you know, but having that name, selling out that kind of, I don't know what the business model was, but having that name attached really did negatively impact how I perceive Cordon Bleu graduates. And it doesn't even matter where they come from.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people would, you know, inevitably people would have a good meal at the restaurant and they would start talking to me and they'd say, hey, you know, where did you go to culinary school? Because in any other business, like if you win them a big legal case, like, hey man, you're amazing. Like, where did you go to law school? Like, oh, Harvard. Like, yeah, you know, next time I'm going to hire another Harvard lawyer. You guys are badasses. And I would always just kind of get flustered by the question because, you know, yeah, I went to the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco, but that's not where I learned how to cook. The only thing that offered me is I actually made a couple of good connections with other classmates that are still great chefs to this day. And I was smart enough. I wasn't smart enough to say, oh, $60,000 tuition? Yeah, no thanks. I wasn't smart enough for that. But I was smart enough to say, oh, you know what? I should probably check out this whole fine dining thing. So, you know, I begged my way into La Folie and, you know, started working just as their bitch, really. But it was so invaluable to me. And then I would take all these things that I would see them doing in the kitchen that they wouldn't let me touch because I would inevitably fuck them up. And I would take them back to the culinary classroom and I would say, hey, give me that lobe of foie gras, give me that chicken, give me that beef tenderloin. You know, I'm going to try something with it. But I looked at my student loan balance the other day. I was shocked by how much I still owe on that. I was absolutely shocked. Like, I'm going to be fucking 54 by the time I pay this thing off. It is absolute insanity. And so I'm looking at this Grub Street article, and it says, all U.S. campuses are run through a partnership with Career Education Corp., which operates school as a for-profit chain that's lately expanded into online management degrees.
Oh, geez.
But, I mean, it's like, yeah, so they're a career education corporation, and they're like, well, we can have people sit in their home and access data online and give them a certificate that says, hey, guess what, buddy? Now you're a manager. Or we can have them come to a culinary campus that has expensive stoves, equipment, knives, gears, chef hats, chef pants, food that they fuck up all the time. What is better for us as a corporation? So, of course, they decided to shut down all of their culinary schools.
Yeah.
And it
says, I think it's the best thing for those culinary programs because there are people who care. And hopefully some of them can scrape the money together to start over again.
Yeah.
And actually bring in passionate instructors or chefs from restaurants who are like, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life, you know, in the past. What else can I do as a chef? Oh, I can maybe affect the next generation. There is opportunity there if the culinary schools will take advantage of them.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go back, though, and chime into what you said about you begged your way into a fine dining restaurant and took back what you observed there to your education. And I think the key piece there is you really get what you put into anything, any educational program you sign up for. I was in a community college program and worked and learned some really fantastic techniques from both my work and from school. And I have a chef buddy of mine who went to the Art Institute for culinary school. I mean, so he's, $60,000 in the hole as well. But he went out and bought himself, a sausage stuffer. He bought himself a meat grinder. He actually went and bought all of these things or begged, borrowed, and stole, possibly, from the restaurants where he worked. And he came out as probably the only successful Art Institute graduate I've ever seen. And he leveraged that into becoming the sous chef of Blue Acre Seafood in Seattle and then leveraged that into a stage at NOMA and then became a research chef at Alinea and spent a couple of years there. I mean, his pathway and his skyrocket to somewhat the top of our culinary world was entirely because of what he did with that and what you did with your education, and had nothing to do with the program, obviously.
Right. Well, and that's my rub is, I mean, if anyone out there wants to go to culinary school, go to a community college.
Yeah.
Because it's much, much less expensive. And normally those classes are taught by working chefs.
Yep.
So they show up in the mornings, they teach a class, two, three times a week, and they go run their restaurants at night. So they're in it, but there's definitely, for me, there is a predatory nature about, I mean, it says it right here in the article. It says enrollment grew considerably during the recession, right? Because what happens is you had all of these people that were out of work, that had dead-end jobs, and they're like, you know what, fuck it. I'm gonna go get a student loan, and I'm going to go to culinary school. I'm going to follow my dream to be a chef.
Yep.
And then it says the Obama administration crackdown for nonprofit schools is making Career Education Corp's future look bleak. Federal financial aid can be withheld from career schools where students borrow lots of money then earn relatively little after graduating. So you have – and that's exactly what's happening with these culinary schools. The people are borrowing $60,000 to $100,000 to go to these culinary schools. They come out not being able to break down a fucking chicken, which they could learn for free by watching one of my videos and buying like four or five chickens at Costco and practicing. And they start off as prep cooks making $10 an hour.
$10 an hour for a prep cook is really freaking good.
Yeah, I've always been kind of a softie with my pay rate.
Boy, no kidding. You're absolutely right. I mean, and full disclosure, I've watched your video and bought the chickens.
Yeah.
Because that was one, that was our second semester final exam, was breakdown of chicken. You know, I think if we, the chef there gave us 5 minutes. So by then you should probably have that stupid thing Frenched.
Yeah.
And everything. But yeah, I mean, it's insane. How these programs really preyed on people and really just suck the freaking dream out of the whole thing. Because, you know, you go to culinary school probably because you have a passion for it. It's been elevated past trade schools at this point. And especially people in their second careers, they probably got school debt from whatever their first degree was, say it was psychology. No offense to the psych majors out there. And then they're tired of working their government job or their, you know, whatever school job. And then they get laid off because some younger blood is just cheaper, because that's just how it is. And they go to culinary school. They pay a gosh darn crazy amount of money. They don't get the exposure that they need to be successful at all. Now they've just got a $60,000 piece of paper that they can hang behind their other bachelor's degrees or whatever.
But you mentioned trade schools though, but like, so you go to a trade school to be a mechanic. Mechanics make a shit ton of money compared to cooks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like hourly wage. And if they wash out of the industry, at least when their heater core goes out on them, they don't have to pay $1,200 to fucking replace it. Right? Can you tell I've been through that recently? Ooh,
that sounds like a hit home close.
Oh, yeah. Man. And then another $500 for the radiator after that.
Oh,
so,
God.
Yeah. So, I mean, so even if they wash out, at least they know how to fix their own car. Right. Yeah. You know, you have guys going to like these IT schools, which can be considered a trade school. They come out with IT jobs that aren't paying them $10 an hour. And guess what? Their tuition didn't cost them $60,000 either.
It's crazy. So, yeah. You know, I actually have a buddy from culinary school who he and I worked at Modernist Cuisine together. And after I went off to go work for Cheese, he went to go work for Whole Foods because he wanted to go corporate and be a cook for them and kind of climb the ranks there. But he actually found that the understanding of labor laws in the food industry is insane and cheats the system pretty considerably. And we could go on all day about that. But he ended up quitting the food industry altogether, and he's now an apprentice electrician because he's making almost as much as he made when he was a sailor and works a third the number of hours and actually gets to take a lunch and a pee break if he needs to.
I almost did that. So right before I went to culinary school, when I was at SF State, I was a security guard. I was a mall cop at the Metreon in San Francisco. Hmm. And I would always walk around being buddy buddies with their electricians. And I was talking to the head electrician one day, and he's like, yeah, you know, you start off like at $17 an hour, and it takes like a year for you to like work through like the phase one. Then you move up to like $24. Wait. You start at 17?
I know.
You know, and like, and their union. I mean, all these things that he was telling me, and then you know, in my arrogant brilliance, I was like, nah, I'm going to go spend $60,000 on culinary school and make $10 an hour. That sounds way better, bro. Way better. There's definitely a passion thing. You know, I wasn't passionate about screwing in light bulbs and doing electrical wiring, you know, like that wasn't my passion, although it might have been at the moment, it might have been a much more logical step to make as far as, you know, it's like go get a job, but the thing is too is that I think I would end up just driving myself nuts because I've never been that kind of person that, you know, you go get the job and you get your benefits and you work your 40 hours a week and, you know, you do what the boss says and you screw in this light bulb and you wire it like this. You know, I would need some form of creative release.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know. He doesn't sound happy. He sounds like he's providing for his family. And I understand that piece too, the responsibility element of it. I do totally respect that. I'm not dogging on his career at all. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a serious loss for the culinary industry because he had a really unique way of cooking. I loved having him in the kitchen because his ideas were kind of out there. And you'd say, okay, well, that's, you know, I think he did a turmeric coconut ice cream that was savory for one of our dishes, because I was working on a coconut sablé, and we ended up making this really cool kind of coconut savory, inspired by Indian curry, but wasn't, kind of dish. And I wouldn't have thought of all of those components had it not been for him. Mm-hmm. And he's gone in the sense of he's never going to touch food professionally again because of the pay, because of, you know, his disillusionment with the kitchen industry. And it's just, it's a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's this, this idea, and I've been a strong proponent of the idea of, you know, you should be passionate about the work that you do because that's your best bet at being great at what you do and being happy. But then there's the flip side of the coin but as a chef, you're trading that for work-life balance. If you're an electrician that's pulling down $100,000 a year plus benefits and you're working 40 hours a week and you get 4 weeks paid vacation every year, you have plenty of opportunity to get that enjoyment from other parts of your life. Mm. Versus you look at the schedule of a chef, yeah, you better be getting some form of creative release and some sort of enjoyment out of your career because that is your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I checked in with a chef friend, again, that Kraken Kanji chef, and I was like, hey, chef, how's it going? Happy holidays. I'm sure you're in the restaurant right now. And he's like, hey, yeah, happy holidays. I'm in the fucking kitchen all the time. And it's like, yeah, but this is your restaurant. This is your gig. I mean, I hope you love it because you better love it to be there as much as you do because it's a craft. And honestly, again, I think our modern consumer has elevated chefing to this glorious David Chang gets to travel the world experience. And it's not that.
Yeah.
I think people need to go back and read Kitchen Confidential and say, oh yeah, remember before Anthony Bourdain was like the hottest swearing, tattooed, smoking chef on television, he was a fucking cook and he hated his life. And we need to remember that that's part of the experience as well. And honestly, that's why I jumped out of day-to-day restaurant and went corporate because it wasn't the life that I wanted to lead at this age because I'm not a 17-year-old kid who's trying to make it big and be the next, the next big restaurateur out there.
Yeah. And then it's funny because that 17-year-old kid in 20 years or maybe 15 years, it's like, congratulations, you're the newest 3-star Michelin chef. Now, don't lose those stars. Good luck, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, and like then they have all this weight on their shoulders and it's just, it's like, look at like attorneys. I know nothing about attorneys except I got a couple of friends that are attorneys and they work insane hours right out of law school and they have big student debt. They get paid good, obviously, but the whole idea is they're going to keep working and keep working and keep working. And then one day they're going to make partner. And when they make partner, they're still going to work, but at least they're going to be able to cool their jets a little bit. They're going to sit back and be able to kind of enjoy what they worked for and what they've built. And I mean, the pressure doesn't even really start until your name is on that menu. The pressure doesn't even really start until you start getting all these positive reviews because now you have something to lose. And the thing is positive reviews are actually hard to write. So from a journalistic standpoint, a positive review is really, it's difficult to write a positive review that's going to really keep your attention. There's only so many flowery adjectives you can use. But a negative review, a takedown piece of a once great restaurant, now that's compelling. Everyone wants to read that. So once you get to that place, you always have these, so you got to really be on your game because you have these people wanting to see you fail. You have these people who can't wait to take you down, talk about your greatness in the past tense, and you feel that struggle on a day-to-day basis while you're still not making that much and you're paying off a $60,000 student loan, you know? So I don't know. It's this very weird dynamic. And I think it'll be interesting to see how all this plays out in the next 10 years, because I think something has to change because from the inside, I've seen a lot of broken people that shouldn't have been broken, but the industry as a whole is broken.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know how to fix it, you know. But also, it's no longer. I mean, I don't think it's. I don't know. I mean, I wish I eloquently could express how to fix it, but I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you going to watch the NOMA documentary called My Perfect Storm? I think that just released fairly recently, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably check it out.
I'm curious. Especially since Chef Rene just talked about, you know, idealizing how he wants to be as a chef who's now made it, who now realizes that he's a dick and he should change things. But the question that kind of ran through my head when I was reading the Lucky Peach article about fantasizing a better kitchen environment and how Chef David Chang also talked about, you know, going to the light side instead of the dark side and choosing to be a better person. These are perspectives written from chefs who have made it. What about from the guys who are still trying to climb the ladder or who've just opened their own thing? And they're not only are they not paying themselves, they're, you know, working 99 hours a week or whatever it is. They go home enough to shower and brush their teeth, maybe, and then come back into the kitchen. You know, how do you change that culture? How do you really say, hey, chef, I know you're working really hard. All of your life savings is in here. Try not to be a dick, though.
Yeah, and that's exactly. Yeah, try not to snap on people after, you know, you've worked a 100-hour work week and you've gotten maybe, you know, 10 hours of sleep in the past 4 days. You know, try not to talk to that sensitive waiter so harshly, please. If you can, chef, if you can remember to say please and thank you when you give me an order, that would be really great, you know. You know, it's, and I think the people that I really feel for, you know, you have the Renés and you have the Thomas Kellers and there's of the world, and there's no taking anything away from them. They were able to break through to the other side, and they have earned and they deserve every single bit of good fortune that they have. But just below them are these amazing chefs that are that own and operate, you know, one Michelin star restaurants that are giving people amazing food, or maybe a two Michelin star restaurant, amazing food day in and day out, or no Michelin star restaurants, you know, and to make that happen, to keep that quality up, you know, that chef is sacrificing so much, and people come back and they'll shake their hand and, you know, good job, chef. I really love this restaurant. But after a while, it's, you know, how do they sustain when they're going, I mean, because they're going home, you know, with really a subpar paycheck. You're not ever going to make good money. You're not ever going to be paid what you're worth until you start hitting that David Chang level of fame. And then you just have people throwing deals at you left and right. But the guy who's working 100 hours a week, you know, maybe pulling in 70 grand a year as the chef owner of his own restaurant with all of the burdens of, you know, paying taxes and writing payroll and hiring and firing and training, that's a really tough gig to be in.
Yeah. I remember when at Modernist Cuisine, I think they were paying $15 an hour. And I was like, oh my God, like, what do I do with all of that money? It's, you know, $30,000 a year. I haven't seen that side of 30 in a very long time. You know, and it was just like, you do realize that secretaries make more than that, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the manager at my local Starbucks makes more than that. Or the assistant manager
probably.
At my local Starbucks makes more than that. I mean, not probably, for sure. So be careful. Be careful what you wish for, kiddies. You know, it's like it's funny because I've been having a lot of meetings with people lately, and the new venture that I'm doing with just the online education and the you know, doing like traveling and doing the boot camps and doing the on-site restaurant consultation, even without advertising, it has really kind of blown up.
Awesome.
And I was talking to a local chef and a couple of people who have approached me in the past about funding a restaurant in the area. And I'm like, you guys are like, are you not listening to what I'm telling you right now? I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life at this current moment. And you want me to open up a restaurant and build out this grand fine dining restaurant and be on the hook to you as investors for $800,000 or, you know, whatever it's going to take to build this place out? Like, are you shitting me right now? So what? So I can go back into the restaurant and run it and you know, spend that 100 hours a week and freaking out and being constantly under stress. So you and all your investor buddies can come in once a week and sit at the table and toast to your success while I'm back in the kitchen fucking breaking my balls? No, thank you. You know, no, thank you. Give me maybe in 5 years we'll have that conversation. But right now I'm not touching a damn restaurant with a 10-foot pole because you can't pay me enough to do it.
No way. No, I mean, once you get pushed in away from restaurants and into your own ventures as a consultant chef, where you get to come in, do the fun, you know, R&D, Gordon Ramsay, Kitchen Nightmare style fixer kind of work, there's no way you're going to open another restaurant. Well, let's talk in 5 years. But
right.
I just can't see wanting to go back into that. Unless, again, you change that format or you know, that's the time that you're like, I'm going to do this passion project bow truck.
Right.
Because now I don't need all of the accolades and the pay because you've already got that from other sources.
And that's what it would be, too. It'd be something simple. I don't know. Business oriented. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely nice to, you know, I love the R&D side. I love the execution side. I love the troubleshooting side of being a chef. But then once I get a kitchen dialed, I mean, I'm kind of bored with it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but then you run into that, the golden handcuffs thing where it's like each time you're kind of, your boredom comes to the service and you're getting ready to leave. They're like, well, you know, here's a raise, stay this much longer. And then you know, stay that much longer. And like, well, here's another raise, stay this much longer. And you're like, well, shit, you know, I do have a family. I do, you know, have a kid. You know, it's so you kind of fall into that monotony. But now it's like, I mean, you know, flying into a place for a week or two and helping someone kind of fine tune their kitchen, fine tune their execution. It's a lot of fun. And then you bounce. So yesterday also too, I mean, because I love the obviously the online content creation. And yesterday I really felt like I hit on something. I had a bunch of podcasts to record, like some Ask Chef Jake ones that I've been putting off. And I didn't get around to recording them because I went on YouTube. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to live stream the recording of this. If you guys kind of want to see a behind the scenes thing, you know, watching me, how I, you know, go through and stumble through recording these podcasts, you can watch. And I was expecting just, you know, a couple of people to tune in. All of a sudden my chat box just starts filling up with these questions. So now I'm doing a live Q&A on YouTube, you know, live streaming it. Then someone says, hey, you know, you should do a call-in show. And I'm like, well, I don't really know if I can do that. But, you know, here's my Skype name. You know, call me at Stella Culinary. And then I ended up answering like 5 or 6 phone calls over Skype that was live broadcast. So like it turned into like this impromptu like call in culinary show, which was a lot of fun. It was great. And I was doing that on a Saturday afternoon, you know?
That's awesome.
And I got off and I was just on such a high. It was so much fun connecting with people and answering their questions. And then I took my family out to dinner. You know, it was a great Saturday. And people are trying to entice me to like open up my own restaurant. I'm like, you guys are out of your minds.
Well, especially, I mean, this time you didn't have to wake up and think, and then I was dreaming and had to go to my shift.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh man, that is so cool.
So yeah, I want to work out some of the bugs because I'd like to eventually be able to have guests like yourself on and then do a call-in show. You know, they dial up Skype, or maybe we do it through a Google Hangout or something. Because, you know, you can knock out so much good info when you don't have to wait for them to type in a response in the chat box or check the form response. You know, when you're doing a live back and forth, you can really, you know, get down to whatever their issue is and figure it out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a lot of fun. All right. Well, I mean, yes, Le Cordon Bleu, they're closing. Good riddance.
Good riddance. That's right. That's how we got onto that. But yeah, I mean, living the dream, finding that pathway to get there. I mean, I'm definitely not an advocate for the expensive programs unless you have a really solid plan on how to use that network and that access. You know, again, that's why I chose the community college I did, because like you said, you have chefs who have restaurants coming in and teaching courses, and a lot of us got hired into those restaurants. And that was exactly how I got to work for the chefs that I did, and how I met the Modernist Cuisine team was through the network. And that was the biggest advantage I had. And I paid all in equipment and the whole shebang, I think less than $3,000.
Wow.
So, well, and some of that is because I was already up to my eyeballs in debt from graduate school and undergrad. So my debt that's lasting until I'm 85 years old is a mixture of things, but it's all there for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I do believe that, you know, work ethic will get you there. You know, it's just like anything. So, but it's also applying that work ethic correctly and in a in a smart fashion. You know, I mean, my default sort of go-to mode in the past has always just been like, oh, I'll just work more. I'll throw more work at it. And it would work, you know, it would get the job done. But there's something to be said about working smarter, not necessarily harder. Mm-hmm. And I found that one out the hard way. but yeah, but you know, it's really hard for me to actually bash on culinary schools because, you know, we don't have access to an alternate universe where I didn't go to culinary school, you know, where I didn't spend that time in San Francisco. And, you know, I mean, who knows? I mean, every little thing will influence your life and kind of become this sum of who you are as a person. And I'm extremely happy with where I'm at in life right now. I feel very, very fortunate. And, you know, so I wouldn't trade anything because, you know, maybe culinary school was that one little, you know, secret ingredient in the sauce that got me to where I was. Looking back, it wouldn't be the first thing that I list as contributing to my success and my happiness. But, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
You never
know. Could have been an electrician in mall cop for the rest of your life and see where that goes.
I know, right? Well, the mall cop thing actually wasn't that bad. It was a decent hourly wage. And check this out. We would work 4 10s a week.
Oh,
so you
nice.
Do 4 10-hour shifts and you get 3 days off in a row.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, how sweet is that?
Yeah, I think you might have blown it by deciding to go be a chef. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the jury's still out on that one, but I could always go back and be a mall cop. I mean, they'll hire just about anybody. Well, Kimberly, it's always a blast having you on. Thanks for filling us in on your Hong Kong trip and spending time with us today on Stellacast.
Yeah, absolutely my pleasure. Whenever any of your listeners or you and your family get to go to Hong Kong, give me a buzz or send me a note, and I'll definitely fill your ear with more details and some addresses for you.
Will do. And when, what's the best way to get a hold of you and check out your work?
My blog is called Peas on Moss, PEASONMOSS. It's an alliteration play on mise en place. And you can, I think there's a contact me page on there with my email address and my latest thoughts. And I do actually have some details of the locations that we visited, so you can kind of get a teaser that way too.
Oh, cool. Make sure you send me a link to it, and I'll put it in this episode's show notes.
Will do.
Cool. All right. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Stellacast. I want to thank Kimberly again for joining me. It's a really fun conversation. I love talking to Kimberly. Wealth of knowledge. It's just fun sometimes just to hang out and talk shop. You know what I mean? This episode's show notes with all the links can be found at stellaculinary.com/scast17. And that will drop you right into our show notes with all the links that we talked about in this video and much, much more. Actually, who am I kidding? Not much more. It just babbling for this episode. So I appreciate you hanging out with us the entire time. Also, too, F-Step curriculum now available online at stellaculinary.com. Just click the shop link at the top of the page, and you can download the first section of F-Step, F is for flavor, for free just by signing up for our email newsletter. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you in the next episode.